So with that, I think we're ready to get started. Again, we're going to kick things off with a few introductory notes, and our first speaker is going to be Jim Belke from EPA. Jim, are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay, go ahead. Thanks.
Hi, everyone. My name is Jim Belke, and I'm from EPA's Office of Emergency Management, or OEM, as we say. OEM is the organization within EPA's Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response that implements EPA's emergency response and removal programs under Superfund. We also develop and implement federal regulations related to accident prevention, oil spill prevention, and emergency response. We'll be discussing three of those regulations and statutes that we implement, those being CERCLA 103, CERCLA is the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation and Liabilities Act, or Superfund, and Section 103 is the part of that that deals with emergency reporting requirements, EPCRA, which is the Emergency Planning and Community Right to Know Act, and then Clean Air Act, Section 112R, which is more commonly known as the EPA Risk Management Program. So those are the three statutes and regulations we'll be discussing today. OEM also implements the oil spill prevention regulations, FPCC regulations, and the Federal Response Plan, Facility Response Plan regulations for oil spill response, and regulations under the National Contingency Plan. So we have a variety of regulatory roles in this office, but the three we'll be discussing today are CERCLA 103, EPCRA, and Clean Air Act 112R. So if you go to your second slide, you can see that this is a two-hour seminar, and this seminar was adapted from, as Gene mentioned earlier, a half-day training course that we provide at our OSC Training Academy, and it's designed for federal on-scene coordinators. OSCs are on-scene coordinators, federal officials that respond to major releases or environmental emergencies, oil spills and the like, and have authority to lead the cleanup action and response action. So this seminar has been sort of adapted from that half-day training course, and so while we're going to focus on, you know, all of the regulatory and legislative requirements, a lot of our remarks and some of our slides were developed with the on-scene coordinator in mind. We realize that not everyone on the in the seminar today, listening to the seminar, is an OSC or is a necessarily somebody that would respond to emergencies, but we think that you'll still find some, we hope you'll find some usefulness out of this material. So we'll focus on the basic regulatory and legislative requirements, and we'll provide an overview of those three sections, those three statutes and regulations. Let me introduce the other instructors. If you go to slide three, from EPA Region 6 in Dallas, Texas, Steve Mason will be talking. Steve is a federal on-scene coordinator, has a lot of experience with all three of these regulations and statutes. Lynn Beasley is here in EPA's Office of Emergency Management, and she will be leading the portion of the seminar on CERCLA Section 103. Cynthia Jacobs is also with EPA's Office of Emergency Management and will be leading the portion of the seminar on EPCRA, and then I'll be the last person to talk, and that'll be on the Clean Air Act Section 112R portion of the seminar. So if you go to slide four, these are our course objectives. Again, this is going to be a pretty basic overview of the regulatory and statutory requirements. We'll get a little bit more in-depth where we talk about release reporting and response requirements, again, because of the tie-in to the on-scene coordinator roles. And we'll talk a little bit about how these regulations can interact with other agencies' regulations related to hazardous chemicals. So before I turn things over to Lynn to discuss CERCLA 103, I wanted to give Steve Mason in Region 6 in Dallas a couple of minutes to have a few remarks. Steve?
All right. Thanks, Jim. As Jim said, I'm an on-scene coordinator with EPA Region 6 and have been dealing with all three programs since they basically started in 87. And so really what I wanted to cover, because I know Lynn and Sissy and Jim have a lot to cover, is just to kind of give an introduction. Why we use this information, why it's so important to us. And the first thing I would point out is, unlike RCRA or AIR or the water programs, the number of pages in the Code of Federal Regulations for these three programs is actually really small. Between the three programs, they only cover about 40 pages of the Code of Federal Regulations. But between the three, they also cover more facilities than just about any other environmental statute or regulation that we have. And Sissy or Lynn or Jim may be able to help me on this. I know that on the EPCRA side, we estimate somewhere between 500,000 and 1,000,000 facilities are subject to the regulations that Sissy's going to talk about. And in terms of the RMP program, Jim, I think it's, what, about 15,000 facilities are covered by that. And so
a little bit. It's in the 13,000 range now, but, yeah, that's about right.
Okay. On the CERCLA side, one of the things I did want to point out is, and Lynn's going to talk about this, but the spills go through the National Response Center. And if you look at the National Response Center database, since 1990, EPA has received a little over 1 million phone calls through the National Response Center under CERCLA and also under the Oil Pollution Act to spills that have occurred in the United States. And what that does is it gives us the option or the opportunity to respond to those spills if we get those notifications, and Lynn's going to go over what those notification requirements are. But more importantly to me, why we have all this information is to be able to do planning and preparedness activities. Under the Oil Pollution Act, there's a requirement that we have to do area contingency planning, and the locals and states obviously have to do planning also. And by using this information, we can all better plan for emergency responses and disasters. I'm assuming a lot of the people on this call are probably response support corps members. And so, and one of the things that I want to point out is that during Katrina and Ike and Gustav and even Rita, one of the things that we were able to use this information for other programs is when our water program wanted to go out and check the status of all the wastewater and water facilities that had been impacted by the hurricanes, what we're able to do is pull the EPCRA information on other chemical facilities that might be around those water plants so that they knew if there was any potential dangers that they were walking into ahead of time, that they weren't just going to be blindly going into areas that may have also been affected by the hurricanes and have, you know, drums that have been impacted or tanks or anything else. And so, just because you're not in one of these programs doesn't mean that this information may not be valuable for you, whether you're in a hurricane area or tornado area, or one of the big things we're looking at now is the earthquake areas around the New Madrid fault line, and that affects obviously four regions and seven or eight states. And so as they go through all these different programs, keep that in mind of how this information may be able to be useful in your program for planning for any big emergencies or just even day-to-day activities. And so with that, I'll turn it back over to Jim.
Okay, well, I'm going to turn it right back to Lynn, who's going to lead the CERCLA 103 section of the seminar. Lynn?
Okay. Good afternoon, everyone. If you turn to slide 6, which is statutory and regulatory background, the primary regulations on notification are under CERCLA, which was enacted in 1980, and those include recordable quantity adjustments and also the continuous release reporting requirements. And then under SARA, which was enacted in 1986, we've got the emergency and hazardous chemical inventory forms and community rights to know reporting requirements. Slide 7. Big picture, under CERCLA, the primary notification purposes are to identify sites that may warrant a Superfund response action and also give the federal authorities notice in case of accidents or emergencies. And under EPCRA, it's the primary notification is to states and local authorities for emergency planning. Slide 8 is just a summary of those reporting requirements, and you can look at those briefly. Slide 9 are basic reporting notification requirements. Under CERCLA 103, essentially the person that's in charge of the facility would call the National Response Center when a reportable quantity or more is released into the environment. Under EPCRA, which is EPCRA Section 304, a facility owner or operator would call the state for the local Emergency Planning Commission and the State Emergency Response Committee when an RQ or more has left the facility. Okay. Slide 10 is just a brief intro. What is a facility? Then moving to slide 11, under CERCLA, a facility is defined as any building structure, installation, equipment, pipe, pipeline, et cetera. It's quite a long listing. Under EPCRA, it's more, the facility is geared more towards all buildings or equipment that are located on a single site. So while CERCLA is a very narrowly defined facility, EPCRA is much broader. And when a release occurs under EPCRA, you're looking at the release actually leaving like a plant location or a site, whereas under CERCLA, if it's dripping out of a pipe, it's reportable. Slide 12, what is a release? What is a release? Pretty broad, again, any kind of spilling, leaking, pumping, pouring, etc. The key is that it's going into the environment. Slide 13, some examples, releases into the environment are releases directly to land, air, or water, and that's surface water or groundwater. However, if you have a release that is wholly enclosed, it's not considered into the environment and would not be reportable. And some examples of that would be if it was going into a closed system or container, or if it's released into a building that does not actually go out into the air, it's not reportable under CERCLA. We also have controlled releases, if you move on to slide 14, and these would be releases that are disposal into landfills, specifically under RCRA or TSCA, which is, TSCA is, Toxic Substances Control Act, and RCRA is the Resource Conservation Recovery Act. And also discharges to POTWs, which are publicly owned treatment works. Okay. Next, moving on to aggregating releases, with slide 15, and if you move right on to slide 16. Essentially, under CERCLA, if you have a release from several different facilities, and so several pipes or buildings on a site, you need to aggregate all of those releases at your facility to determine whether or not in a 24-hour period there's been a release of an RQ. The notification requirements happen very quickly. So as soon as you've got within a 24-hour period, as soon as you've triggered the reportable quantity, you need to make the notification. If you move to slide 18, this is just a graphic that shows an overlap between CERCLA hazardous substances and the EPCRA extremely hazardous substances. The point of intersection of the two circles are where you've got CERCLA hazardous substances and EPCRA extremely hazardous substances on the same list. Okay, moving on to slide 19. The EPCRA extremely hazardous substances were originally in the Chemical Emergency Preparedness Program guidance, and then when EPCRA was enacted, they just picked up that list and added that to EPCRA. We also have the authority to add to it. Moving to slide 20, the CERCLA hazardous substances. The CERCLA hazardous substance list is a compilation of several different agency lists. It includes Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act, the Toxic Substances Control Act, and also the Resource Conservation Recovery Act. CERCLA also provides the agency with the authority to add additional substances if we feel that when released to the environment would prevent substantial danger to public health, welfare, or the environment. You can find the list of hazardous substances with their reportable quantities at 40 CFR 302.4. And that's a table we're going to be going over some pages on that table shortly. Moving on to slide 21, the Clean Water Act hazardous substances, there's actually two sections of the Clean Water Act where we picked up lists. One is the original Clean Water Act hazardous substance list, which is at 311B4, but also the 307A list, which are toxic substances, Clean Water Act toxic substances. Some of the CERCLA hazardous substances are Clean Water Act hazardous substances. We also, if you move to slide 22, how we come up with the names for the hazardous substances, we essentially pick up whatever the name was on the list from the statutory source, we use that name in the CERCLA list. Okay. So moving to slide 23, got a several pages that follow with screenshots from the CERCLA hazardous substance list, just so you can identify. The first red circle over the statutory code, the code numbers in that column indicate the original source of the hazardous substance. So if you see a 1 next to it, it means it came from the Clean Water Act 311, a 2, Clean Water Act 307, a 3, Clean Air Act 312, or 4, RCRA. Some of them have just one source. Some of them have three or maximum of four sources. And then the column next to that, if it's a RCRA waste or RCRA source, it has the specific waste code listed next to it. And then the last column is the reportable quantity, and it's given in both pounds and kilograms. There's also a dagger symbol that on several hazardous substances throughout the list, and that indicates the 100 micron rule applies. And essentially what the 100 micron rule is, for metals, if the metal released is larger than 100 microns, it is not reportable. Then moving down to the next red circle, we've got asterisk signs, and that is indicating that no reportable quantity was established, and that's because these are broad generic categories, and there can be many, many chemicals that fall into that category, and so to establish an RQ that would fit all of them, the agency felt that didn't work. It's still a hazardous substance, and you would still be held accountable or liable for the release, but it's not a reportable release. And then finally on this page, there are a triple dagger, and it applies to asbestos, and it's indicating that for asbestos releases, it's only to the friable form of asbestos. The next page shows another squiggly, I guess it's a suction sign, and that's just an indication that this substance is a radionuclide, and we have a separate table under Appendix B that cover radionuclides. Moving to slide 25, very bottom, there's a double pound sign, and it just it's another indication that there's no reportable quantity, and that's just because the agency has not yet established it. We have not made a determination that there will not be an RQ. We just haven't gotten to it yet. And then finally, on 26, it's just a screenshot of the notes, just to let you know that at the end of the table is where you can find the different notes to the table. And then at the bottom of that page is Appendix A, and Appendix A is the hazardous substance list listed by in order of the CAP number. Okay, and then moving to slide 27, just a brief overview of the CERCLA hazardous waste. We have listed waste, which there are P waste and U waste. We have F waste and K waste, and on the slide there's a description of each of those wastes. And then we also have unlisted or characteristic waste. Generally 100-pound RQ. However, if it is an unlisted waste for toxicity, it may have an adjusted RQ other than 100 pounds. Okay, and then moving to slide 28 is just showing the bottom of one page where you see the unlisted characteristic waste, and then flowing on to the second page where you have the unlisted characteristic waste for toxicity with the individual RQs for those toxic wastes. Okay, moving to slide 29, a little bit more overview of the hazardous waste. Releases of waste are not individually listed as CERCLA hazardous substances. That's where you get into an F waste, where an F, a P, a U, or a K waste, where it'll have a name for the waste, and then it'll tell you what's in it or what that waste came from. So it could be some kind of a production source, and then it will give the expected elements of that waste. CERCLA reporting requirements apply to the waste or waste streams that exhibit the characteristics of ignitability, corrosivity, reactivity, or toxicity under RCRA. And we also have the characteristic waste, as I talked about before. And I guess the most important thing on this slide is under RCRA regulations, a substance becomes a waste after it's released and not cleaned up, or if it's cleaned up for eventual disposal. So if you release one of these waste streams and it's not yet a waste, you're going to pick it up and use it for some reason, they wouldn't consider it a waste, so CERCLA wouldn't consider it a hazardous substance. Okay, moving to slide 30, we also have a mixture rule that applies for CERCLA hazardous substances. And essentially, how this rule works is, if you have a mixture, and if EPA has listed that mixture as a hazardous substance, we will assign an RQ to it. But we also have a listing of what the elements of that waste or mixture are. If you know the concentration of the constituents in that mixture, and they're different than what EPA has assumed, you can calculate the RQ on your own. You don't have to go with EPA's default RQ, but you can use the default RQ. Okay, so slide 31 explains it a little better. Basically, if you have the exact composition of the waste stream and it's known, you would report when the constituent released is in excess of the reportable quantity. If the exact composition of a waste stream is unknown, you would report when the total quantity released exceeds the RQ for the waste stream listing. Slide 32 is just kind of a pictorial of that. Okay, and then briefly, slide 33, a little discussion about continuous release reporting. CERCLA 103, which is the reporting requirement, under Section F2 has provisions for reporting if your releases are continuous and stable in quantity and rate. And basically what you would be reporting is your releases in advance. So, for instance, if you have a one-time release, you would call the National Response Center and report that release. If you have a release that you know is going to happen every day, once a week, once a month, or some predictable amount of time, you would call the National Response Center, tell them you have a continuous release, and then you'd submit a written report to the agency that basically explains that release, gives some details about the release. And then you would not be obligated to call every single day that you have the release after that, unless you're outside of your original written report. That written report is followed up 1 year after the initial report, and you're also obligated to report if you have any statistically significant increases from your report. Slide 34 is basically a summary of the CERCLA and ECRA reporting requirements. When in doubt, report. And then last few slides, there are some exemptions that apply. If you're not a facility, if it's a consumer product that's being used in consumer use, so for instance, ammonia is a hazardous substance. If you're using ammonia, you know, in your house to clean your windows with and you fill it, you're not going to need to call the National Response Center. And ECRA also has an exclusion for household products. Slide 36, we have what's called federally permitted releases. If you have a federal permit and you're operating within your federal permit, you don't have to report those releases under CERCLA or ECRA. We do have a list under CERCLA what constitutes an allowable federal permit. So it's not just any federal permit, it's a specific federal permit. Slide 37 goes into a little more listing of different permits. And but moving to slide 38, what is not a release? Workplace, if it's just an exposure within the workplace, that's not a release. Emissions from engine exhaust, et cetera, those are not releases. Releases from special nuclear material from a nuclear incident is not a release under CERCLA. That might would probably be under the nuclear regulatory authorities would be releases. Normal application of fertilizers are not releases. And slide 39 is a summary of CERCLA exemptions. And slide 40 is a summary of ECRA exemptions. Okay. Moving to slide 41, kind of the relationship between liability and reporting. Failure to comply with the CERCLA 103 notification requirements could result in fines of up to $37,500 and prison sentences. You need to make your notifications quickly, immediately, in order to avoid charges against not making notifications. And then finally, if you have a release that's below the reportable quantity, you don't have to report it, but you still could be liable for that release, which could include cleanup costs. And then just final slide page 42, CERCLA has a provision under 306A for the transportation of hazardous materials or hazardous substances, and they're basically regulated by the Department of Transportation, and they DOT uses the CERCLA list in order to create their regulations for transportation. So with that, any questions?
And also, Steve, if you wanted to interject anything here, this would be a good time.
So just a clarifying question. So pollutants and contaminants would not be considered as hazardous substances, correct?
That's correct.
I'm going to clarify something you said. You releases below the RQ are not reportable, but you are responsible for the cleanup of those.
Yes.
Any other questions or comments on the CERCLA section? Okay, then we're going to jump right into the Emergency Planning and Community Lake Canoe Act, and Sissy Jacob will lead this portion of the seminar.
Hi, everyone. Just going to give you an overview of the EPCRA law, starting with the first slide. Back in December 1984, that's slide 45. Back in December 1984, toxic methyl isocyanate gas was released accidentally from a Union Carbide plant in Bhopal, India. This accident took away about 3,000 people's lives and permanently damaged 10,000 more. Less than a year later, slide 46, a similar incident happened in Institute of West Virginia. Although it was not as devastating as the Bhopal incident, it also took away 100 people's lives and injured. The conclusion about the Bhopal incident, why it was so devastating, was that lack of communication, emergency response, and community awareness, of course. So this alerted the U.S. government, and then the Congress enacted the Emergency Planning Community Right to Know Act, slide 47. The law was passed or signed in on October 1985. 1986, sorry. And basically, this law was passed to improve community awareness, and prepare the community for emergency, releases of hazardous chemicals. There are five major sections, in the emergency, in the EPCRA, statute. The first three are related to emergency planning, and then the last two bullets that you see are more geared towards community right to know. And I'm going to basically just give you an overview of what each section of the law is. Section 301 of EPCRA requires the governors of each state to establish the State Emergency Response Commission. And short, it's called, they're called CERCs. And the CERCs were to appoint the local emergency planning committees for each of the planning districts in their state. And some of the statute also directed that the members of the LEPC should include representatives from local government, enforcement, civil defense, and firefighting, and even facilities. Pretty much about 3,000 LEPCs are around the country. Most are active, and my point is. So Section 302 gives responsibility for the state. EPA. Basically, EPA is. Was tasked to publish regulations and list of chemicals and threshold quantities for facilities to report. All the implementation and enforcement are handled at the state and local level. Section 302 is applicable to any facility that has any extremely hazardous substance present at any time at above the threshold planning quantity. And under this Section 302, the facilities have to... Section 302, facilities have to give this one-time notification to the FERC and LEPC that they have an EHS above the threshold planning quantity. And LEPCs have, and also they have to designate a facility emergency coordinator. And LEPCs then use that information to develop and implement an emergency response plan. So they can, LEPC can request any information from facilities that that they need to develop the plan. So under Section 303 of EPCRA, slide 51, under Section 303 of EPCRA, the LEPC is required to develop an emergency response plan, and these plans are required to be reviewed annually or more frequently if changes occur in their community. Although Section 302 is a one-time notification that facility needs to report to the FERC and LEPC, anytime they get a new chemical or any other changes occur to the facility, they have 60 days to report that information. And then LEPC may have to revise their annual, revise their emergency plan according to the information that is given to them. Slide 52. The emergency release notification. Lynn covered the circular release notification. So after EPCRA was passed, an additional requirement was placed for facilities. In addition to reporting to the National Response Center, any extremely hazardous substances that are released have to be reported to the state, the CERC and LEPC. So this is in addition to the circular notification. And, of course, the facilities have to have a hazardous chemical produced, used, or stored in the facility. Okay, slide 54. What is different from CERCLA? There is no petroleum exclusion. So that means if any facility had a release of a petroleum substance and any EHS are present in that product, the facilities have the above the reportable quantity, the facilities have to report that release to the FERC and LEPC. And they don't need to report any release that are to the FERC and LEPC that happened within the facility boundaries, only that is released outside. Okay, we'll move on to slide 55, the hazardous chemical reporting. This section, the section 311 and 312 of EPCRA are applicable to hazardous chemicals that are required under OSHA to have an MSDS. So there are some exemptions under OSHA hazardous chemical standard. And there are also some exemptions from hazardous chemical under Section 311E of EPCRA. And, of course, there are any substances that are in transportation are not required to be reported under Section 311.312. 556. Some of the examples of exemptions under OSHA hazardous communication standard is hazardous waste regulated under RCRA. And some the consumer products such as windshield wiper fluids or that are used at the facilities or any other that are used personally by employees are not reportable. Anything that that are present at the facility in bulk form has to be reported, like bulk cleaning solutions have to be reported under this section. And if you want more details on OSHA's exemptions from hazardous chemical, you can go to their website, OSHA.gov. Flight 57. Although OSHA HCS exempt many or require have MSDS for many substances, there are some exclusions under EPRA sections 311 and 312. Some substances that are regulated by FDA, such as chlorine, to reach flour in a manufacturing facility. Sheets of metal in storage do not need to be reported. Heating fuel at home do not need to be, that's also like a personal household product. But in business buildings, if they have number two fuel oil or any other in bulk quantities, that has to be reported under Section 311 and 312. 58. Okay. For the CFR Part 370 are where the regulations of hazardous chemical reporting, and there are some thresholds applicable to extremely hazardous substances and other hazardous chemicals. Extremely hazardous substances are chemicals that are, as I mentioned earlier, in Section 302 of EPRA. They're used for emergency planning. They have a lower threshold than other chemicals that are covered under this section, these sections. EHS have a 500 pounds or the threshold planning quantity, which are listed in 40 CFR Part 355, which are less. And gasoline have a 75,000 gallons. Now, only those, the gasoline that are stored at retail gas stations where they meet the underground storage tank requirement. Gasohol is the 90% gasoline and 10% ethanol. Have a 75,000 gallon threshold as well. Diesel has 100,000 gallons. But all other hazardous chemicals, like I mentioned earlier, fuel oil, propane, all these chemicals have a 10,000 pound threshold. Slide 59. Just want to mention about the alternative fuels that are used nowadays. The E85, E95. These substances also are considered as non-EHS hazardous chemicals. They also have a 10,000 pound threshold at the moment. You want to slide 60? Okay, hazardous chemical reporting. There are two parts to it. One is the submission of a material safety data sheet, and that's under Section 311, and the hazardous chemical inventory reporting, which is a form that is due by March 1st of every year. Next slide, 61. Okay, under Section 311, facilities have to submit their material safety data sheet or a list of hazardous chemicals that they have at or above the threshold to the State Emergency Response Commission, Local Emergency Planning Committee, and the local fire department. This, as I mentioned earlier, is a one-time submission. Unless the facility gets a new chemical at their facility, then they will have 3 months to report. Slide 62. Section 312, it is an annual reporting requirement. Any facilities that have any of these hazardous chemicals, including the extremely hazardous substance at or above the threshold planning quantity, have an obligation to report annually to the three entities, the State Emergency Response Commission, Local Emergency Planning Committee, and the Local Fire Department. And it is due March 1st. Annually, for any information that they for all the information on the chemicals that they would have in the previous calendar year. So, coming March 1st, 2010, they would have to report all the chemicals that are at or above the threshold quantity that they would have in 2009. And EPA has create a tier 2 submit. It's an online reporting, or they can download and report And a lot of states also have their own reporting format that facilities can use. Okay, next slide. These two slides are just a sample of what the Tier 2 looks like. In it, they would have the chemical description, the CAS number, and the physical health hazards, and inventory. They have codes listed, but it would refer to how much they have on site daily, and the storage codes, like what kind of containers they use and when the water temperature or pressure. And also, the Tier 2 form also shows the storage locations of the facility. So this is some of the information that will be available to the emergency responders as well as the material safety data sheet. I believe these two forms are state forms. Since the ECHO statute is implemented at the state and local level, the statute gives authority to the states to have their own community right to know reporting requirements and their own forms of reporting. And they could, so they could have additional chemicals and the federal requirements. And even the thresholds.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Yes.
And also, if you look at slide 66, so this is the second page of a Pennsylvania Tier 2 form. You'll see here that on some of these, for some of these hazardous chemicals, the facility has indicated that the storage location is confidential. And this sort of reporting has arisen out of security concerns over hazardous chemicals stored at these facilities around the country. And if a facility can do this, they can specify a confidential storage location, but if they do that, they have to submit two versions of this form to the state. They have to submit what they would call a sanitized version, which would have confidential in the storage location, and then they have to submit a second version, which they would call unsanitized, which would provide the full storage location to the state so that their emergency response personnel could have it. The public right to know, if a member of the public asked for the form, they'd be given the sanitized version without the storage location, but where the state would provide this to their emergency responders, they would get the full disclosure, including the location. And you can also see in this state form that, as Tiffany mentioned, some of the states, they have authority to have additional reporting requirements, and in the state of Pennsylvania, in the inventory column, you can see that they've had the facility actually report the quantity instead of a quantity code. So in the inventory column, you can see the number of the maximum daily amount for each chemical, the actual quantity that's stored on this site instead of a quantity code. So there's more information on some of the state forms than is present on the EPA form in some cases.
Okay, slide 67, section 324 of the law, which is one of the reasons for creating this, was for the public to get information on potential risk in their community. They get information, any information that are submitted to the state and local, except for trade secrets, it is available to the public. Okay, that covers the EPCRA. Do you have any questions?
Any questions on the EPCRA section? Steve, do you want to interject anything?
No, I'm good. What's the difference between Tier 1 and Tier 2?
Tier 1 has general information about chemicals at the facility, which actually no states accept that. Pretty much all the states require either Tier 2 federal form or the state form. The Tier 2 contains specific information about the chemicals at the facility.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Any other questions on the EPCRA section? Okay, we're going to move along then to the Clean Air Act Section 112R portion. and you get to listen to me, that's Jim Belkey, for a few minutes here. So I'm starting on slide 69, and this is on the Clean Air Section 112R Risk Management Program. And then moving to slide 70, the Clean Air Act was amended. The original Clean Air Act is from the 70s, but it was amended, a major amendment in 1990, did a couple of things in the accident prevention area. All of these, the first three of these four bullets were programs that were enacted in the amendments of 1990. Not a lot of people are aware that the OSHA Process Safety Management Standard, or PSM standard, was actually enacted in the Clean Air Act, an EPA statute, in 1990. And that authority was given to OSHA to implement a process safety regulatory standard for chemical facilities. And OSHA came out with that in 1992. And in a different section of these amendments, EPA was given the authority to implement a similar process safety program for chemical facilities. And those regulations were published between 1994 and 96. And those are what I'll mainly be talking about over the next few slides. The Chemical Safety Board, the Chemical Safety and Hazard Investigation Board, is an organization that is analogous to the National Transportation Safety Board, except that the Chemical Safety Board investigates chemical accidents at fixed facilities and does not investigate transportation. It was enacted in 1990 but never funded until 1998. So the board has actually been in operation now for 11 years, and they do investigations of catastrophic accidents at chemical facilities in the United States. And you can get a lot of good information on their investigations by going to their website at www.csv.gov. They have investigation reports, and they also have safety videos, which are really good illustrations of some of the more severe accidents that have occurred in the last few years. Then the last bullet refers to this very ineptly titled act called the Chemical Safety Information, Site Security, and Fuels Regulatory Relief Act. This is actually an amendment, a separate amendment to the Clean Air Act. And what was at stake here was that just before the RMP information, which I'll talk about shortly, was going to be made available to the public via the Internet, Congress began to get concerned that some of the information in the risk management plans that facilities were submitting had some sensitivity from a security standpoint, and they passed this law sort of at the 11th hour that sort of restricted public access to some of the information in risk management plans. It did not completely prohibit public access to those portions of the risk management plans, but it did make it a little bit more difficult for a member of the public to gain information related to things called worst-case scenarios and alternative relief scenarios that are contained in risk management plans. That will make a little bit more sense when I get to the portion of the slides that deal with that information. So if you go to slide 71, Clean Air Act Section 112R did a number of things. Firstly, it established a general duty clause, or it established a general duty on the part of chemical facilities, and that's an important aspect of the Clean Air Act because it serves as sort of a bottom level of performance that facilities that handle hazardous chemicals have to meet in order to handle those hazardous chemicals safely. In addition to this general duty that it established, there was a regulatory program that was enacted. And that required EPA to list at least 100 substances that were known to cause death or serious adverse effects to human health and the environment. And then based on that list and threshold quantities that were promulgated, required EPA to pass regulations and guidance that were intended to prevent, detect, and respond to accidental releases of those substances. And those regulations, Congress said, had to include something called a risk management plan, or RMP. And this is a summary of the facility's risk management program with a lot of information about what's contained on site and where. And these were to be available to the government officials at all levels, federal, state, and local, but also to the public, although that latter access was restricted somewhat by that that last statutory program. So a little bit, now I'm on slide 72, and I just wanted to cover a little bit about the general duty clause. The General Duty Clause of the Clean Air Act simply placed an obligation on the owner or operator of a hazardous chemical facility to identify hazards associated with a potential accidental release using appropriate hazard assessment techniques, then to design and maintain a safe facility, taking what steps are necessary to prevent releases, and then if a release were to occur, to minimize the consequences of that release. So the interesting thing about the general duty clause of the Clean Air Act is that it's not limited to a specific list of chemicals or threshold quantities like all these other reporting requirements are. The general duty clause simply says that if you have an extremely hazardous substance, and the act, in this area of the Clean Air Act, it defines extremely hazardous substance very broadly. It's not tied to any particular list. It simply means any substance that demonstrates itself to be extremely hazardous for its use. If you have one of those, then you have these obligations, these three obligations. And the way EPA uses this clause is we tell facilities that we expect them to meet and exceed the industry codes and standards that they're subject to for design, operation, and maintenance. So if a facility is subject to a particular API standard or an ASME standard, if we visit the facility, whether or not they're regulated under the risk management program or one of these other regulations, we expect them to be meeting their codes and standards. We also use it in enforcement actions after a large accidental release has occurred where there's been some severe damage or people have been injured or killed or there's been an evacuation. We can often use the general duty clause as an enforcement mechanism against facilities that haven't demonstrated the general duty. Now I'm on slide 73. Now for the regulatory program that the Clean Air Act Section 112R set out. It first said that EPA had to list at least 100 regulated substances. EPA did that and in the end listed 77 toxic and 63 flammable substances, so a total of 140 listed regulated substances under this program. And we also included toxic mixtures or flammable mixtures if they had more than 1% of a listed substance in the mixture. In the case of toxic mixtures, if the pressure was high enough to get airborne, and for flammable substances, if it met the highest NFPA flammability criteria. And then there were for a few substances that were listed with specific concentrations. And then I'm in slide 74. Based on that list and the threshold quantities that were promulgated, facilities were to look at that list, and if they had one of those substances above the threshold quantity in something called a process, then they were going to be subject to the risk management program requirements. And what this program was designed to do was prevent accidental chemical releases to the air, and in particular, releases of substances that were acutely toxic or highly flammable such that they could harm or kill people immediately if they were released, minimize the consequences of releases that did occur, and then provide information about those hazards to the public and government officials in the form of the risk management plan. Down on slide 75. In order to be subject to the regulations, a facility had to meet four criteria. First of all, it had to be a stationary source, which is EPA's regulatory term, which sort of separates fixed facilities from transportation sources, so we don't regulate transportation. It had to be a stationary source. It had to have at least one of those regulated substances. It had to be above a threshold quantity, and the substance had to be contained in something called a process. Process is another regulatory term of ours, which is very broadly defined under this section of the Clean Air Act and the regulations to mean essentially any container which stores the or reacts or contains. Is there a question? Again, a process is a general term that describes the storage or reaction vessel or any group of vessels or pipes that can contain a substance would be a process. So just about any container which holds one of these substances would be considered a process, even if it's only used for storage. And then it had to be above a threshold quantity. I'm on slide 76 now. If you were subject to the regulations by meeting those four criteria, you had to do these five things. First of all, you had to do an off-site consequence analysis. The off-site consequence analysis I'll talk a little bit more about in the next slide essentially consists of something we call a worst-case scenario and alternative release scenarios, which are sort sort of estimates of the for the in the case of the worst case scenario, what's the worst that could occur if everything failed and the substance was catastrophically released? How far off-site could the effects of that be felt? The facility also had to report the history of accidental release as meeting certain regulatory triggers that had occurred at the facility over the last 5 years. And then most facilities had to implement an accident prevention program, and the accident prevention program was sort of the core of this regulatory program. And these are the steps on site that facilities would take to prevent these regulated substances from being released and harming people. And they would include steps like having written operating procedures for all aspects of plant operations, having a mechanical integrity program to make sure your pressure-containing equipment and your regulated substances containing equipment is in good shape and good working order, is well-maintained. The facility has to do something called a process hazards analysis, which is sort of a systematic look at the possibilities for failure in the process, and then implementation of engineering controls that would fill those any gaps that were identified. And there are a number of other, there are about a dozen accident prevention program elements that are all specified in the regulation at 40 CFR Part 68 that have to be met for the facilities in the highest tier of prevention programs. I should mention that under the accident prevention requirements, we split facilities up into three different levels of accident prevention program depending on their potential risks to outside receptors, and I'll talk about those in another slide. Then we also required facilities to have an emergency response program or plan in place. And then lastly, facilities have to summarize the risk management program in the form of a risk management plan and submit that to EPA. And then EPA makes those plans available to state and local governments, to the Chemical Safety Board, to the public with some limitations, et cetera. And now on slide 77. So slide 77 illustrates what we require from facilities in terms of these worst case and alternative release scenarios. So this is obviously a fictional map, and we don't actually require facilities to submit a map like this with a risk management plan, although we do give facilities the option of submitting a map to illustrate the worst case scenario. And some small minority, about 10% of facilities, actually do submit a map. But what we illustrate here is what these sort of exercises that a facility would have to go through in calculating their worst case scenarios. What they would do in the case of toxic substances, they would look at all the toxic substances that were regulated under the program. They would postulate the catastrophic release of the largest vessel with each toxic substance, and then do an atmospheric dispersion modeling exercise to estimate how far the substance would travel, the release would travel, before it was diluted to the emergency response planning guideline level 2 point, the ERPG level 2 point, which is the point at which a person could be exposed for up to 1 hour without suffering severe irreversible health effects. And that distance that they would calculate via dispersion modeling would be called the distance to the endpoint. That distance is submitted in the risk management plan. In addition to reporting that distance, the facility also has to estimate the population within a circle whose radius is equal to that distance using the latest census information and report that to EPA, as well as the presence of any other receptors, what we call public receptors or environmental receptors, which are within that distance to the endpoint. So on the fictional map here, some of these icons sort of represent that within the facility's worst-case toxic scenario, the big green circle, you see like a residential community, a commercial area, and perhaps a state park or national park, which would be considered an environmental receptor. Those categories of information, along with the population and the distance, would be recorded in the risk management plan. And then the smaller circles represent what we call alternative release scenarios. And these were intended to be more realistic scenarios, which are smaller but more likely than the worst-case scenario, but that still reached an off-site endpoint. And the idea with the alternative release scenarios was that these would be more useful for emergency planners and responders to represent the sort of scenario they might actually see at this facility if things were to go wrong. So we told facilities when they were developing these alternative release scenarios to look at the actual history of releases at the facility. Had they had a piping leak or a flange leak or a hose rupture in the past, if they had, you know, estimate what the effects of that release could be, and these would be more useful for emergency planners and responders. This information, the worst case and alternative release scenario portion of the risk management plan, is the part of the plan which is restricted from public disclosure. We still allow the public to gain access to this portion of the plan, but they have to go to what we call federal reading rooms. There's one federal reading room in each state and in the District of Columbia. Here in D.C., it's actually located here in the EPA headquarters. And in other states, it's either located at the EPA regional office or a federal office building like the Department of Justice or FBI headquarters in that state. And by appointment, usually, a member of the public can gain access to up to 10 risk management plans, off-site consequence analysis information per month by going to one of those reading rooms. If you're a federal, state, or government, federal, state, or local government official, you can get access to this in database form, and I'll explain how that happens. I'm now on slide 78, and this slide talks about the different prevention programs that exist under the risk management program regulation. Each process at a covered facility is placed into one of three program levels, and a program level denotes how much of the accident prevention program requirements of the process the facility is required to meet for that process. Program 1 processes are those which have, after the worst-case scenario analysis is done, have no public receptors in their worst-case zone, and they've had no significant accidents with off-site specific off-site effects in the last 5 years. If both of those criteria are met, that process can qualify for Program 1, and Program 1 has no accident prevention program requirements beyond meeting the general duty clause requirements. If it doesn't meet those two criteria, and the great majority of facilities and processes regulated under programs do not, then they fall into either Program 3 or Program 2, each of which carries some prevention program obligation. Program 3 would be processes that don't meet Program 1, and that are already covered by the OSHA Process Safety Management Standard, or if the process falls within one of 10 specified industrial classification codes. NAICS stands for the North American Industrial Classification System, and it's just the way that the Bureau of Labor Statistics and the Census categorizes industrial processes depending on what they do. And we picked 10 codes, 10 industrial classification codes, which had a high history of accidental releases. And we said if a process falls one of those 10 codes, then it has the highest prevention program obligation, which is Program 3. Program 3 is essentially identical to the OSHA PSM standard requirements. And then every other process regulated under the program, if it's not Program 1 and if it's not Program 3, falls into Program 2, which is a more streamlined set of accident prevention requirements under the program.
Here we go, Sheriff.
And now, is there a question? I'm now on slide 79. The emergency response program requirements essentially depend on whether a facility chooses to use its own employees to respond to releases or whether the facility is going to rely on public response authorities like the local fire department or a local hazmat team to respond to their accidental releases. So if you go to slide 80, for facilities, I call them non-responding facilities. If you have a process in Program 2 or Program 3, but your facility is one that is going to rely on public authorities to respond to any emergencies, then your only obligations under the emergency response program requirements of this regulation are that you have the appropriate notification mechanisms in place to notify of an emergency, and then you have to coordinate your response actions with the Community Emergency Response Plan that Cissy discussed under EPCRA. If you have toxic chemicals, you coordinate with the local emergency planning committee and that community emergency response plan. And if you have just flammable chemicals, you coordinate your emergency response actions with the local fire department. The idea there is that the local authorities that are you're going to be relying on to respond to an emergency at your facility have advanced knowledge of what you have and where it's located and what you're doing at the facility so that when they show up, they know how to respond properly to the emergency. I'm going to slide 81. If, on the other hand, you are a facility that is going to use your own employees to respond to releases, you have additional requirements under the Emergency Response Program requirements of the RMP rule. These facilities have to have an emergency response plan that addresses equipment procedures. You have to know how to use the equipment that you're going to rely on if you're a responding facility, that it addresses medical treatment and first aid for exposure to the substance that you have or the substances that you have, how to notify public, the public and local authorities if you have a release. You have to have procedures in place for equipment inspection, testing and maintenance, and you have to train all your employees. So you have a much higher obligation if you're a facility that's going to respond to your own releases. You can probably imagine that the type of facilities that choose to take this route tend to be the larger, more sophisticated facilities. Many refineries or the big petrochemical plants will have their own response brigades, whereas most of the other most facilities in general regulated under RMP will choose to be what we call non-responding facilities, and they will rely on local authorities to respond to releases. I'm going to slide 82. Slide 82 talks a little bit more about what's contained in a risk management plan that's submitted to EPA. The plan contains a number of different data fields, and this is essentially submitted electronically in the form of a data stream to EPA. So a lot of it is quantities and check boxes on whether or not you have, you know, this type of accident in your accident history, or if you had an accident investigation, you know, what was the cause of it. We also provide some textual information in the form of an executive summary, which provides some very useful information about what the facility is doing in terms of their production process and what chemicals they have on site. So this sort of summarizes the facility's risk management program, and they submit it to EPA, and then EPA has a big database of risk management plans, which right now there are about 13,200 active RMP facilities in the country, but the database contains the entire history of RMPs throughout since the beginning of this program. So there's over 50,000 RMPs historically in that database, and for each facility it contains all this information. This is really useful information for people that are involved in response or emergency planning, because it has a lot of information you can't get anywhere else, or at least not anywhere else very easily, about the facility. So in the next few slides, I'm going to show you some screenshots. And starting with slide 83, I'm going to show you some screenshots of a system we call RMP Info, which is a data system which you can use to query the risk management plan database for specific facility information. And I'll explain if you're a federal, state, or local government official that has the need to know this information, you can get access to RMP Info via the EPA's Central Data Exchange, or what we call CDX. And the first and these next several screenshots are actually screenshots of what it looks like when we get access to RMP Info through CDX. CDX is the agency information nexus that is used by various regulatory programs within EPA for facilities to report information under those programs. So there's probably more than 20 different regulatory programs that use CDX as an information portal. In addition to submitting RMP information via our system called RMP eSubmit, you may be familiar with the TRI submission under Section 313 of EPGRA, which the EPA calls the Tri-Me system. And there are lots of other data systems which use CDX as the information portal. So in this first screenshot, I'm just showing you what it looks like when you initially were to get access to RMP information. If you were a federal or state official that wanted access to the full RMP info plan, you could get the OCA version of the RMP info database, which is the version that contains all the worst-case scenario information. Or if you didn't want to have access to that because you were concerned about it from a security standpoint, we also offer access to a non-OCA version of the database. If you go to the next slide, slide 84, this screenshot just shows the once you get into the risk management plan, the RMP info query screen, you can query a facility by a bunch of different fields. You can query it by its name, or if you know a DPA facility ID, you can query it by that. If you go to the next slide, you can query it by zip code or by city. In this case, I just put in a query for facilities in Texas City, Texas, and I just told the system to bring up any facilities which are in that zip code. And if you go to the next slide, slide 86, you'll see that the RMP info system returned two facilities from Texas City. And then I'm going to show you some additional detail about the first of those facilities, which is called IST Technologies in Texas City, just to give you a flavor of what's available in the Risk Management Plan database. So the next slide is slide 87. So this is actually within the facility's RMP now, and you start to see the sort of information that you can get. If you go to the next slide, slide 88, you see some more facility information, facility latitude and longitude. So if you need to plot the facility using some GIS application, you have their lat and long. You have their mailing address, the title of the person who's responsible for implementing the RMP at the facility, if you wanted to contact them. Let's go to slide 89. It also provides an emergency contact. So if you're a responder or a planner and you need to talk to this facility about some planning issue, it gives you the actual contact for the person at the facility that's responsible for that, the name of their LEPC, how big the facility is in terms of the number of employees it has, whether it's covered by some of these other regulations, including EPRA. If you go to slide 90. This slide shows there's a section that'll take you to their accident history if the facility has reportable accidents meeting RMP criteria. And it also just shows all the other sections that you can click on to get additional information about the facility. Or you can just download an entire copy of the facility's RMP to look at offline. I want to show you a couple of slides of the executive summary. If you click on the link executive summary, so I'm in slide 91, the executive summary is the facility's opportunity to just tell us in longhand form what's going on at the facility. And it provides a lot of useful information that you can't always get out of just looking at data elements. And I've circled in red at the bottom of the screen where the facility has just given a pretty good but brief description of the facility. And it tells us here that this plant is a Texas City plant. It's a manufacturing facility. It tells us what chemicals are manufactured, how big the site is geographically, when it was formed, the names of all the chemicals. So there's a lot of good information here that you could use as a planner or as a responder to know about what's going on at this facility. Further along the executive summary, slide 92, there's some information here about the facility's emergency response program. And it tells you that it's got a written emergency response program, and it tells you how it coordinates with the community and the LEPC. So there's a lot of good information here if you take the time to read it. And then slide 93 is back to the screen where you can see different sections of the RMP that you want to click on. And if you were to have this open and click on processed chemicals, it would bring up slide 94, which is a screenshot of what the chemical information in this RMP. So this facility submitted information on four regulated substances. These are all RMP regulated substances, and it shows you what the chemical is, what the CAS number is. CAS is Chemical Abstract Service Number. It's a unique chemical identifier for that chemical. Shows you the quantity they have in the process and whether the hazard in that chemical is toxic or flammable. So anyway, there's just a lot of information you can gain from looking at RMP Info. If you are interested in getting access to RMP Info, if you're a federal, state, or local government official, you can get access to the full database with OCA information. The way to do that is you can either, if you know who your regional CEPP coordinator in the EPA regional office is, you can contact that person directly. And since this is EPA and the federal government, of course, there's a form you have to fill out. It's a one-page form. It's a pretty easy form. And you explain what your role is in your government, your local or state government, or if you're another EPA fed. And they will give you access to that by contacting headquarters, and we'll set you up for access via CDX. If you are a federal government official here in the D.C. area and you want to get access to this, you can contact us directly, and the person to contact is named Armando Santiago, and you can send him an email at santiago.armando@epa.gov, and he can set you up for access. If you're not a government official, if you're a member of a company or a member of the public and you want to get access to some of this information, you can do that by sending a FOIA to the agency. And if you go to the EPA's eFOIA page, which is just www.epa.gov/FOIA, there's a link on that page for submitting an electronic FOIA request. And if you submit one of those and ask for the non-OCA version of the RMP Info database, we will send you a CD, a compact disc, which contains the full database minus the off-site consequence analysis information, which is restricted from public access. Okay, if you go to slide 95, this just shows a map with the geographic distribution of where all these RMP facilities are throughout the United States. And, you know, you see a lot of these facilities where you might expect to see them in some of the heavily industrialized areas near the major cities and major port areas of the U.S. But you also see a lot of red dots throughout the Midwest, and just about all of those relate to one chemical, which is ammonia, which is used, of course, throughout the farming belt of the United States for fertilizer. So there's a lot of fertilizer storage depots and cooperatives throughout the Midwest, and that's why you see so many red dots there. And then going to slide 96, this just shows what the breakout of the RMP processes are by process and by chemical. And here again you see that the biggest slice of the pie is ammonia. Since so much ammonia is used in agriculture and for refrigeration in food warehouses, there's a lot of ammonia regulated under this program. A lot of chlorine because it's used frequently in water and wastewater treatment. And flammable mixtures you find in refineries and petrochemical plants and fuel depots and places like that. So it's interesting that on this slide, seven chemicals account for 75% of the RMP universe. Even though we have 140 chemicals listed, it's really seven that account for the bulk of the regulated universe. If you go to slide 97, this shows the same information but by quantity instead of by process. Here you see that the big slice of the pie is devoted to flammable mixtures. And the reason for this is that while that was the third or fourth, I guess flammable mixtures was the third most frequent process type, it's the largest in terms of quantity because you have some very, very large processes under this category at refineries and at storage depots that have hundreds of millions of gallons of flammable mixtures in storage. And if you go to slide 98, this shows just an industry sector breakout of the RMP universe. And again, the blue slice is agriculture, and that's almost completely ammonia. Chemical manufacturing, of course, is regulated under the program. Energy is a big sector, both in terms of production, which would be refineries, but also in energy sale and intermediate energy transport facilities like depots. Water and wastewater is a big sector, although a declining sector. We see more and more frequently that a lot of facilities are choosing to eliminate gaseous chlorine and use an alternative disinfection technology. So this slice of the pie has actually gotten smaller in the last 10 years as more and more facilities have transitioned away from using gaseous chlorine. And then food and beverage is also ammonia. And then the last slide, slide 99, this just shows the trend of reported accidents under the program since the inception of the program. The program, the first RMPs came to the agency in 1999, but they were required to have a full 5 years of accident history information. So that's why the accident history goes back, actually goes back to mid-1994. 95 is the first full year that we had accident information for. And you can see that as time has gone on, the number of accidents reported under the program has declined. So for whatever reason, we think that's a good thing. And that is essentially it. Does anybody have any questions on either the risk management portion of this seminar or any other section? Steve, did you have any concluding remarks from your OSC perspective?
Well, what I was going to mention is when Sissy was talking about the EFCO program, of course, the basis of all of it is the LEPCs, the local emergency planning committees. And for the people that are on the call from the other regions and even Region 6, what I would point out is, as she was saying, there's over 3,000 LEPCs. Some of them are very, very active. Most of them are active to somewhat active. Then there are a few that we have a hard time even getting to admit that they are LEPCs. But for the ones that are active or very active, they have actually gone beyond just what the EPCA rule itself is. They're not just collecting Tier 2 forms or the spills, but they've actually gotten into some other areas, such as the household hazardous waste programs. They're helping to sponsor the household hazardous waste programs in their area. We have some in our region, in Region 7, that have got involved in the school lab chemical cleanup program. We have some LEPCs that have gotten involved with facility siting and permitting issues and things like that. So what I would suggest is people that are in the other programs, whether it's the air or water or RCRA or TOSCA or FIFRA or whatever, that if you've got something that you want to get going at the local level or have a workshop or something, you might talk to your EFCA or CEPO person in your region to get them, you know, get them involved and tie it to the LEPC, because those LEPCs are obviously very involved with the facilities in their area and the local communities. And I do know one of the big things for, you know, for this next 3 years in this administration is going to be environmental justice. That's something that the LEPCs can also help you work with. We've already, in our region, done some workshops tying in our environmental justice program, the emergency response program, and the RCRA program, and bringing in some of the community groups that may not always be involved with some of the stuff and working through the environmental justice program and tying it to the LEPC. So I would suggest that the other programs look more into working with these LEPCs too.
Thanks, Steve. Any other questions or comments? Jean, did you have any concluding remarks?
No, actually, I don't think I hear any questions that are coming in on the phone lines, and I think everyone of the instructors have had a chance to make their final remarks. So if I could direct everybody's attention to slide number 101, I just first of all wanted to say thank you to the organizers who put this session together. Yep,
hello.
We're here. We can hear you.
There are questions?
Okay, I have a question. When you were talking about the RMP plan for companies that are actually self-responding, two questions. One, your slide said all employees. Is that all employees at the facility, or is that all employees that are responding to the RMP plan?
It means all employees, but at the facility, but related to what their duties are. In other words, if you're a responder, you need to be trained on the equipment and the procedures. If you're an employee that has no response duties, but you're at that facility, you just need to be trained on what to do if there's an emergency, and if you have a rally point or if you have duties for shelter in place, things like that, you have to get the level of training appropriate to your employees. So we expect facilities that are going to respond to their own releases train their own employees, the responder corps or the brigade in their duties. You know, if they have to be able to dress out in level A protection to respond to a toxic chemical release, they need to have that level of training. If you're an administrative person that has no response duties, you just need to be trained to know what to do if you hear a particular alarm at the facility.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Were there any final questions coming in on the phone lines?
Yeah, I have a question regarding slide 27, which deals with unlisted characteristic hazardous waste. You have the second bullet there. I just wanted to ask the question about you have an RQ of 100 pounds for unlisted or characteristic waste. Can you explain that again for me, please?
Actually, our person who was in charge of that part of the seminar had to leave early. Steve, do you happen to know, can you expound on that point?
Well, I think basically, as she was saying, you have listed waste, like the P waste, K waste, and those. And those all have specific reportable quantities, whatever that chemical may be. And you also have unlisted waste that meets a characteristic, either as corrosivity or reactivity, or the TCLT. So if they meet one of those criteria to make it a hazardous waste, then they have that reportable quantity.
So if you had a spill of a characteristic waste of 100 pounds, then that's a reportable quantity spill?
Yeah. And if it was just on the facility site, like onto the soil, then it's only reportable under CERCLA 103 to the National Response Center. If they actually spilled it off-site, like if it got into a water body or if it was an air release, you know, I'm not too sure what it would be, but if it was an air release that went into the air then it would and got off-site, then it would be reportable under HEPA 304 also to the state and LEPC.
Okay, if it was based on toxicity, could you calculate reportable quantity based on toxicity? Or analytical information?
Well, the way that the rule reads, and I know she talked about this a little bit about the mixture, is if they have the spill and if the entire mixture meets the, you know, just like under RCRA where it says the entire mixture would be considered the hazardous waste, it'd be the same thing. That over, if they spilled the entire thing over 100 pounds, if you could calculate out specific amounts of each thing, then you might be able to divide it out. But for most people, they're just going to go with the total amount that was spilled.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Any final questions?
Yeah, I've got a quick one, I think. I was looking at slides 38 and 54, and slide 54 discussed what's different about EPCRA from CERCLA, and it makes a statement that you don't need to report releases solely within facility boundaries. Yet, slide 38 said you don't have to report releases that affect only people on site, workers. Is there just some, to me that doesn't sound like much of a distinction or difference.
Well, I think the best way to describe it is if we start with CERCLA 103, what it says is if the spill stays within the contained area, or only affects people on site. And what they mean by that is, as Lynn was saying, let's say it's released inside of a building. And a good example is we have this happen every once in a while where somebody will have, let's say a refrigerated warehouse will have a release of ammonia. And what it is a pipe breaks within the building itself, and they release more than 100 pounds, which is the reportable quantity. But it doesn't leave the building itself, and all it does is affect the people, the employees inside that building. It's not reportable then under CERCLA 103 because it did not enter the environment, and it only affected people within the workplace, and they mean within the building itself. So under CERCLA, that would not be reportable. If you went to the next stage and said, okay, the release left the building, but as soon as it left the building, they knocked it down with a water fog, and so it didn't leave the facility boundaries itself. It left the building, but it went into the ambient air. It's now reportable under CERCLA 103, but it's not reportable under EPCRA yet because it did not leave the facility boundaries, and so it didn't go into the community. Now, if they can't knock it down, then it becomes reportable, you know, under EPCRA also if it goes into the community. Another good example would be, let's say a facility had a spill of sodium hydroxide, the liquid. Again, the same thing. If they spilled it inside the building, it would not be reportable. But if they spilled it outside the building, let's say from a tank, and it went into the onto the ground, onto the soil, then it's reportable under CERCLA. If it then leaves the facility, let's say it gets into a waterway or runs down a drainage ditch and leaves the facility into the community, then it's reportable under EPCRA 304 also. Does that help any?
Yeah, those examples did help clarify. Thank you.
Okay.
Hi, I also have a question on the same type of issue. If there's a spill into a dike and then it's cleaned up, does either CERCLA or EPCRA release reporting apply?
Well, there's two or three things that you have to look at. The first thing is, was the dike specifically designed to contain the spill or not? And so if it is, then potentially it's not reportable. However, there's two things about that. It has to be an impervious dike, such as a concrete or asphalt or something like that. If somebody just pushes up soil around a tank, then that does not count because that's still considered a spill into the environment because it can soak into the soil and actually, you know, maybe water or whatever. So it has to be an impervious type thing that they have, a man-made thing that they designed to contain the spill from going into the environment. The second thing that they have to look at is to make sure that the release doesn't sit around outside long enough that it may actually still go in the environment. And I'll give you a good example is that we had a facility a few years ago in Region 6 that had a release of benzene. And it went into a contained dike, which was a concrete containment. And so they didn't report it at first because they said, well, it was, you know, it was contained. However, about 2 days later, somebody figured out that unfortunately they had let the benzene sit there so long that a lot of it had evaporated out of the containment into the air above the reportable quantity, which is only 10 pounds for benzene. So at that point, it still became reportable because they had released more than the RQ into the air above the contained area.
Thank you very much. I have a question on the same type of issue. What does immediate mean? Some people say it's 50 minutes, some people say 30 minutes. What does it mean practically?
Nobody will ever give you an exact number just simply because we want to keep it flexible that we expect the facility to do the best that they can and to report it as soon as they have knowledge that they reported it. Now, under the EPCRA history, the legislative history, if you look, they even talk about putting 15 minutes in there, and that's where that number comes from. And I've heard other people say, 1 hour or whatever. What we always tell people is, from the moment that the spill occurred, we want to see that the facility has made a good faith effort to determine if they went over the reportable quantity and made the notification as soon as possible. Because, quite honestly, we've had people that actually made reports 30 minutes after the spill, and you still said that was not considered immediate because they knew from minute one that they had had a spill way above the reportable quantity and took 30 minutes to report it. And because, again, we always go back to, why are they making these reports? It's not so that EPA and the state can build this massive database. It's so that all three levels of government, whether it's the local, state, or federal, can determine, do we need to respond, you know, do we need to send OSCs out? Do they need to respond? And more importantly, at the local level, do they need to put the word out to the community that there's been a release and that people need to shelter in place or evacuate or whatever? And if the facility knows the spill had occurred and didn't report it immediately, then that slows down the chance of the locals to notify the public and take appropriate response action. So, again, I'm just going to tell you that there is nothing that anybody's going to say is specific. I know there are some states that have established, you know, a 15-minute window or an hour window or whatever. If you look at our penalty policy under CERCLA and EPCRA, there's actually three levels of what we consider, you know, if they have a violation. The highest level is over 2 hours. The second or medium level is an hour to 2 hours, and then the lowest level is it was less than an hour that they made the report, but we still didn't consider it to be immediate. You know, let's say they reported it 45 minutes after the spill, but we still didn't consider it immediate because we didn't think that they did a good job of reporting it as soon as they could have. So I hope that helps. So I'm just telling you, there's not really a definitive answer. It's just based on the facility and how fast they can report it.
Okay. Can I ask one more question? What is the reportable quantity for oil?
Okay, for oil, under CERCLA, there is no reportable quantity because, as Lynn said, CERCLA specifically exempted petroleum products and their fractions thereof from reporting under CERCLA. And so there is no reportable quantity under CERCLA. Now, under EPCRA, if there is a constituent in the oil that's listed as an extremely hazardous substance, then they might have to report it under EPCRA. And a good example would be like hydrogen sulfide. If there was enough of it in the crude oil and they had a big enough spill, then they could possibly have to report. But more importantly, under the Oil Pollution Act, and that's where people have to report the oil spills, or the Clean Water Act or Oil Pollution Act, what it says is if there's a spill on the, you know, the waters of the U.S., or navigable waters, whatever you want to call it, and basically if it's a sheen or above, then it's reportable.
Okay, thank you very much.
Any other final questions? Okay, if there aren't any other questions, I just wanted to extend my thanks to the organizers from OSC Readiness who set up this seminar as well as a number of others in the series. I wanted to extend my thanks to the instructors today who put the materials together and actually went through, as well as all of the attendees who were able to sign on and participate. If I could direct everyone to the final slide, slide number 101. You'll have the two links that I mentioned earlier today when we began the session. The first link will bring you to the additional resources page where you can download today's seminar as well as other resources and websites that are related to the topic. And the final link on slide number 101 is a link to our feedback page, where if you could take just a minute or two to submit your feedback and let us know how we did today. I do read each and every one of those and make sure that we use your comments and feedbacks to improve future deliveries. If you need confirmation, again, you can use that feedback form to check a box and have a confirmation email sent your way. So my name is Jean Balance. Again, I work with EPA's Technology, Innovation, and Field Services Division. And this is just one of a number of seminars and a whole series being offered through the Circular Education Center as part of OSC Readiness Training. If you're interested in either attending a future delivery or other courses, feel free to go out to cluein.org/training and take a look at our currently scheduled seminars as well as all the links to the archive sessions to take a look at what we've delivered in the past. Again, in about 1 to 2 weeks, the recorded version of the session will be available for free download and replay on Cluein as well as through our podcast on iTunes. So one final thank you to everyone, and I hope everyone will join us again on a future seminar. This will be the conclusion of today's Internet broadcast. Thanks, everyone, and have a good day.